Good morning. It's time to read the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, January 15. I'm Jane, and my partner at the microphone for the next hour is Karen, and we're pleased to be with you. This broadcast is made possible through a partnership between the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. Here are today's headlines on the front page of the Globe Gazette. Reynolds, let's be bold and visionary. Budget plan would increase spending. Governor calls for a 4.4% bump in fiscal year 2021. And elected county officials' salaries rise. Today's weather will be... The regional outlook is a little snow this morning with little or no accumulation. Breezy this afternoon. Little or no sunshine with a 60% chance of precipitation and average relative humidity 90%. Drying conditions poor, bitterly cold tonight. Average relative humidity 80%, mostly sunny tomorrow. It looks like today the high will be 24 degrees with a northwest wind 10 to 20 miles per hour. And tonight, partly cloudy and frigid, with a 12 to 25 mile per hour wind and 8 below. Is that 8 below? Ooh. Okay. And now with the first story, here's Karen.
Thank you, Jane. Reynolds, let's be bold and visionary. Governor challenges Iowa lawmakers. Governor Kim Reynolds called Tuesday on state lawmakers to take the first bold step into a new decade by enacting a multi-pronged plan to invest in Iowa with tax policy changes she said would raise the state sales tax but also return money to taxpayers, preserve Iowa's water and land, strengthen schools, improve health options, and give every Iowan a chance to succeed. Reynolds used her third condition of the state address to propose her Invest in Iowa Act that would expand upon a voter-approved idea to raise the state sales tax by a penny to fund water quality and other environmental and resource needs, but also take a large share of the new revenue to cut state income taxes by at least 10% and ease property tax burdens by having the state pick up from the counties some costs for expanding mental health services to adults and children. Let's be bold and visionary, Reynolds told a joint session of the 88th Iowa General Assembly and a statewide television audience, according to prepared remarks. Let's seize this opportunity and make the next decade Iowa's best. It's time to show the world that opportunity lives here. The governor proposed instituting a 2010 constitutional amendment passed by Iowa voters that authorized the legislature and governor to raise the state sales tax and direct the proceeds into a wide range of environmental, conservation, natural resources, and outdoor recreational initiatives. Funding that trust is no small investment, but I believe it's one we need to make, she said. As prescribed in the amendment, 3/8 of a new penny sales tax increase, estimated at about $170 million a year, would flow into the Iowa Water and Land Legacy Trust Fund under Reynolds' plan. The new tax would take effect January 1, 2021. But the designated formula for distributing that money should change to reflect current water quality priorities and realities, she said. As a state senator in 2010, Reynolds said she voted for the distribution formula, but said now the challenges we face today and will face tomorrow are different than what we understood them to be 10 years ago, so it's time to amend the plan. Under her plan, Reynolds said, almost 58% of the new money would be allocated for water quality and conservation, or an estimated $100 million annually. That would be a nearly 31% increase. Another $52 million would go for other conservation and outdoor recreation efforts at 14.6% increase. These investments will not only aid our conservation efforts, they will improve our quality of life and help us retain and recruit a new generation of Iowans, she said. While opening the conversation on the I will option, Reynolds said she has no interest in raising taxes, so any increase in revenue, some estimate that to be nearly $380 million, from adding a penny sales tax must be more than offset by additional tax cuts, she said. That starts with continuing to reduce our uncompetitive income tax rates. 2 years ago, thanks to many of you in this room, we passed the largest income tax cut in Iowa history. I said then, and I've said ever since, that wasn't a one and done, Reynolds noted. I intend to make good on that promise, which is why I'm proposing to cut income tax by an additional 10% for almost every Iowan, with lower income Iowans receiving as much as a 25% cut. Let me put that into perspective, she added. Just 1 year ago, our top tax bracket was almost 9%, one of the worst in the country. Now, with this new round of tax cuts, our top rate will be down to 5.5% by 2023. Significant progress that will make Iowa competitive with our peers. Reynolds said Iowa's finances currently are in a strong surplus position that will allow policymakers to make bold plans for now and decades to come. That planning and action, she said, must begin right now, this session. Legislatures convened the 100-day 2020 legislative session on Monday. Along with income tax cuts, Reynolds said she was proposing the state follow up on its recent commitments to bolster mental health services for adults and children by using proposed sales tax proceeds to reduce property tax levies and provide the needed funding through the state general fund. Counties now levy a property tax to help fund mental health care, but do so at different rates. No parent, family member, or friend should be told that treatment isn't available for their loved one, Reynolds said. By establishing a dedicated and stable fund for mental health, we will give hope to so many who are suffering in silence. It's a promise we've made, and it's a promise I intend to keep. The governor praised lawmakers for investing more than $90 million increase in K-12 education last year, including an increase in per-pupil funding and transportation equity. She called on them to spend even more in fiscal 2021 by appropriating more than $103 million in new funding that she said Iowa schools can use to maintain the best teachers and classrooms in the world. In her quest to see the state take bold action, Reynolds pledged an additional $20 million in flood relief to areas of the state hard hit by weather disasters. She also pledged an additional $2 million to the Renewable Fuels Infrastructure Program, as well as modernizing and expanding the E15 Plus promotion tax credit to support the sale of E15 Higher Blend or ethanol year-round, driving domestic demand for Iowa's homegrown renewable refuels. The governor said Iowa must do more to promote and support maternal health, as fewer doctors and fewer hospitals are delivering babies and providing care for mothers, especially outside of urban areas. To help increase the number of doctors who are willing and able to provide OB services in Iowa, Reynolds said she is proposing a fellowship for new family practice physicians who want to train and specialize in OB care. She said she also wants to launch a tele-mentoring system where OBs at institutions can consult the physicians across the state. She said her budget also includes additional funding to expand the use of telehealth services to underserved Iowans. She also called on the Republican-controlled legislature to adopt measures against abortion rights after court struck down an attempt she signed into Iowa last year. As we begin 2020, I'm focused on the overall wellness of all Iowans in every part of the state, in every stage of life. And when I say all stages of life, I mean to include the unborn. We must protect life by making clear through an amendment that our Constitution does not grant a right to an abortion. It's time and unfortunately, it's necessary, the governor said. Calling high-speed broadband critical infrastructure for rural areas, Reynolds said she is seeking another $15 million on top of the $5 million provided under last year's Empower Rural Iowa Act to improve connectivity and adjusting the state match to leverage private and federal funding to build out broadband to every part of Iowa to become the most connected state in the nation. Iowa also called for legislatures to require computer skills be taught as a basic skill statewide, something she said is done in almost two-thirds of school districts, middle and high schools, and about half the elementary schools. She also proposed expanding her Future Ready Iowa initiative to infuse Iowa workplaces with more skilled employees by adding $2.8 million each to the Last Dollar Scholarship and the Employer Innovation Fund, bringing the total investment to over $20 million. Child care is the next workforce issue we need to tackle. It's another barrier for families looking for a way up, the governor said. For some, it's about affordability. For others, access is the issue. And for thousands of Iowans, it's both. This year, we need to act. To that end, Reynolds proposed making child care more affordable by expanding early childhood tax credits available to families making $45,000 or less to double that income threshold to $90,000. She also called on legislatures to begin to address the child care cliff so that we are not punishing parents as they continue on a path to self-sufficiency by implementing a tiered copay system. Included in the governor's workforce initiative was her second chance, approach to focus on prisoner reentry and rehabilitation to break a circle that leads back to prison at a taxpayer cost of $32,000 per year. She also renewed her support to amend the Iowa Constitution so that it no longer bars felons from voting after they have served their sentence. I am grateful to the House for starting this process last year by approving the constitutional amendment with a strong bipartisan vote of 95-2, she said. I also appreciate the productive conversations we are having with senators, and I look forward to continuing to work with you to pass the amendment and craft an implementing statute that lets us avoid the confusion and lawsuits that have plagued other states' restoration efforts. Today, we can help put returning citizens on a path to redemption. We can help them become productive members of society, reduce recidivism, and make our communities a safe place. The governor also called on legislatures to make sure government isn't stifling the ingenuity of Iowans by reforming the state's professional licensuring system. She said it puts Iowa at a competitive disadvantage and cost 48,000 jobs and $290 million. We should never dismiss the importance of protecting the health and safety of the people, but it's been far too long since we've modernized our licensing structure. That's what I'm asking you to do today, she told lawmakers, urging them to adopt universal licensing recognition and to waive fees for low-income individuals. She also called for the creation of a commission that will every 4 years review every professional license requirement and the boards that oversee them. Jane?
Okay. In the next article on the front page of the Globe Gazette this morning is budget plan would increase spending. Governor calls for a 4.4% bump in fiscal 2021. State legislators gave a cautious nod Tuesday to Governor Kim Reynolds' plan to push the state's general fund spending above the $8 billion for the first time in the 2021 fiscal year that begins July 1st. I didn't have that penciled in when I was thinking of a number to come up with, so we'll see, said Senator Michael Brightback, Republican Strawberry Point, chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, shortly after Reynolds unveiled an $8.093 billion state budget proposal for fiscal year 2021. The Republican governor's new budget plan calls for a 4.4% boost, or nearly $343 million more than the $7.75 billion that would be spent this year, presuming that the GOP-run General Assembly goes along with her request to pass a $111 million supplemental request to cover unpaid Medicaid costs and provide $20 million in disaster aid to flood-stricken regions of Iowa. Reynolds' spending plan would provide a 2.5% boost in state aid to K-12 schools that would total $100 million, as well as increasing next year's funding for Medicaid by $167 million. Workforce and rural development initiatives, child care, and other priority areas, but still leaving a projected $386.5 million surplus by June 30, 2021, according to staff briefing documents. Higher education would see a boost of about $18 million more to institutions under the umbrella of the State Board of Regents and a $5.2 million general aid increase to Iowa's 15 community colleges. I'm just anxious to see how she's going to balance this budget, because the spending that she's doing and then the tax cuts that she's proposing, they just don't fit. That is not possible to do both like that and expect there to be money to fund all those projects, said Representative Mary Mashler, Democrat, Iowa City, a member of the House Appropriations Committee. Included in the governor's legislative package was a proposal to boost the state sales tax by 1 cent, effective January 1, 2021, and to use the proceeds to further drive down state income tax rates by $170 million and take over a share of county mental health costs to ease property tax levies, with a net impact of reducing overall general fund revenue by $7.3 million in the second half of fiscal year 2021. Also, 3/8 of the money generated by the proposed sales tax increase would go into the Iowa Water and Land Legacy Trust Fund, as prescribed by a 2010 constitutional amendment approved by Iowa voters. But the governor proposes changing the distribution formula so more money goes to water quality, conservation and natural resources, and less to trails and recreational amenities. Initially, about $37.5 million of the sales tax increase would flow into the I Will Trust Fund in fiscal year 2021, and an expected $81.2 million would be generated in fiscal year 2022. Overall, state officials project that increasing the state sales tax from 5% to 6% annually, along with 1% for local option and 1% for school infrastructure, would generate about $540 million. According to the governor's office, Reynolds' proposed tax policy changes would build on income tax cuts passed in 2018 by accelerating the reduction in rates, meaning effective in fiscal year 2023, the highest of four brackets would be 5.5% and the lowest rate would be 4% compared to 6.5% and a 4.4% respectively under current law. On the property tax side, the governor proposed to have the state take over about $80 million in mental health costs currently funded by a levy capped at 47.28 per region. The new cost share ratio of 70% state money and 30% county funding would be based on a lower county levy of $12.50, while generating enough revenue to cover the expected yearly cost of $130 million to fund adult and children's mental health commitments. The governor proposes what that budget looks like. The House and Senate will determine whether they can meet those goals and whether their visions align with hers, said Breitbach. We'll see how that works out. The governor's budget plan also seeks to fund increases of $15 million for rural broadband connectivity, about $4 million more for future-ready Iowa initiatives like last-dollar scholarships and employer innovations, and make changes to Iowa's child care rules that will carry a $600,000 cost in the first fiscal year. The state is projected to end the current fiscal year on June 30th with a $465 million surplus, but the governor's staff indicated that about $111 million in supplemental funds, $98 million for Medicaid and $20 million for additional flood relief, will push the general fund budget to nearly $7.75 billion. Reynolds' new budget plan would seek to spend about 95.5% of the revenue available under Iowa's 99% spending limitation law in fiscal year 2021, allocating about $342.7 million in new appropriations for a 4.4% increase. I thought she gave a great speech that's very bold and brought forward a lot of issues that are going to be complex and take a lot of work. But I know that our caucus is excited to get to work on a lot of things in there, and we're ready to go, said Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker, Republican, Ankeny.
Okay. Elected county officials' salaries rise. Money front and center at Board of Supervisors meeting. At Tuesday morning's Sarasota County Board of Supervisors meeting, two of the most pertinent pieces of new business revolved around money. In one case, the board was there to decide whether or not to adopt salary recommendations for county-level elected positions. With the other, the three-member panel of Casey Callanan, Tim Latham, and Chris Watts had to decide on tweaking the county's DOC assignment policy and the attached fees. Both were unanimously approved. With those adoptions, elected county officials will receive a 2.75% pay increase. That was decided on by the Sarasota County Compensation Board on December 13th and will not include the board supervisors themselves, as per a motion that Callanan that got a 3-0 vote of approval. The 2.75% increase is consistent with recommendations from past years, as is the board members deciding on a pay freeze for themselves. In approving the freeze, Watts reflected on the recent history of the board and restated a campaign promise of his. It's now been 4 years in a row that the county supervisors have taken this action, Watts said. Five salaries will shift on as a result of the board's decision, including the county attorney, auditor, recorder, sheriff, and treasurer. Attorney will go from $126,768 to $130,254. Auditor changes from $83,116 to $85,263. Recorder ticks up to $80,263 from $78,116. Sheriff goes from $106,113 to $109,031, and treasurer bumps up to $80,263 from $78,116. Anyone in Sarasota County with a public DOC assignment can expect to change for 2020. Fees will now total $200 per assignment, which Sarasota Planning and Zoning Administrator John Robbins said is more in line with Clear Lake public dock fees. Before, it would be $50 per hoist and $250 per dock. According to Robbins, such fees had never been reviewed since the Iowa DNR first allowed the county to offer public dock assignments. Along with evenly distributed funds among those with assignments, Robbins said that he would expect the move would provide extra revenue for staff time and administration of the county docks. Jane.
Moving on to the opinion page this morning, the editorial is Trump played into Iran's hands by killing Soleimani. And this is written by Tim Ackerman, a regular columnist for the Globe Gazette who lives in Miller. This is exactly what I was afraid of when we elected a man with no political, diplomatic, or military experience, a potentially epic crisis. Nearly 3 years into the Donald Trump presidency, it has not turned out as badly as I'd expected. Not that I think he's done much particularly well, mind you. My expectations were simply that low. Given his resume, his colossal ego, and his lack of any filter, I fully imagined Trump tanking the economy, elevating government dysfunction to new heights, destroying alliances, and starting a new war or two. In fact, the economy has proven resilient. Congress, the courts, his own advisors, and bureaucratic inertia have kept Trump from swamping the ship of state. Allies have, for the most part, demonstrated tolerance and restraint when dealing with the president and his antics. And despite his best efforts, remember North Korea, Trump has yet to stoke any new military conflicts. With the recent drone attack and subsequent bluster, however, he may have dangerously escalated the ongoing war in the Middle East. Earlier this month, Trump ordered a strike that killed Major General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, whom many consider the second most powerful man in the country, behind Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. To the U.S., Soleimani was a known terrorist who coordinated with militia groups across the region to attack America and its allies while bolstering Iranian influence. One could easily assume his death has made the Middle East safer for American troops and Western interests. For now, perhaps, but in the long term, not so much. Fomenting discontent within Iran late last year led to mass anti-government protests threatening to undermine the nation's hardline regime. Soleimani was reportedly planning new attacks against American interests in hopes of drawing a military response that would redirect public outrage towards the U.S. His killing has likely brought that about more quickly and completely than any military action he could have initiated. At a time when Trump's unprecedented sanctions had stirred unrest inside Iran, the political elite has just been handed a rallying cry, wrote Mohammad Ali Shabani, a researcher at SOAS University in London. The strike on Soleimani, whose status approached that of national icon, will harden popular sentiment against the U.S. while simultaneously shoring up the regime. Crazy Trump, said Zainab Soleimani, daughter of the slain general, don't think that everything is over with my father's martyrdom. Indeed, Soleimani's successor, Ismail Ghani, has promised Iranian efforts to get rid of America from the region will move forward unchecked. We promise to continue down martyr Soleimani's path as firmly as before with the help of God, he vowed. Iran has also fully abandoned any effort to comply with the 2015 agreement limiting its nuclear program. While Soleimani's killing has done little to alter Iranian policy, it may have damaged an already tenuous relationship with erstwhile U.S. ally Iraq. The U.S. attack was carried out near the Baghdad airport, apparently without Iraqi knowledge or consent. Most Iraqi leaders wish for peaceful relations with Iran, while some openly support close political and economic ties with Tehran. They view the threat to internal and regional stability. As a result, the Iraqi parliament voted to call for the removal of U.S. troops from the nation. While the request is non-binding, failure to honor it could further strain U.S.-Iraqi relations and energize its anti-American factions. Complying, meanwhile, would undermine the international efforts to combat remnants of ISIS and other extremist groups within Iraq and Syria, as well as cede further influence to Iran. The reckless killing of this powerful American enemy, however justifiable it may seem, has created a mess that will be difficult, if not impossible, to clean up with either diplomacy or military might. Both American troops and Western interests will likely suffer as a result.
21 active economic development projects happening in Mason City. This piece is written by Bill Schickel. Bill Schickel is the mayor of Mason City. This guest opinion was adapted from his State of the City address at the January 7th, 2020 City Council meeting. Exciting times. Those two words best describe the state of the city. A vacant big box store, JCPenney's, has been transformed into a state-of-the-art arena, finishing the first phase of our River City Renaissance. By spring, ground will be broken for the Performing Arts Pavilion and the Hyatt Place Music Man Square Hotel. With the opening of 7 new businesses or organizations, the Southbridge Center is almost 70% occupied. One of the newest is the Mason City Parks and Recreation Department, giving this key service a highly accessible permanent home. Further south, another groundbreaking is bringing new life to an empty parking lot. Talon's housing project will showcase our plans to keep and recruit workers. This time next year, there will be a ribbon cutting for 133 apartments and townhouses along Willow Creek. On Main Street, vacant upper levels are being transformed into more needed housing. The street looks beautiful with new sidewalks and plaza entrance cobblestones. The dilapidated hotel on 5th Street Southwest is being transformed into a 46-bed Econolodge. New life is being breathed into a 72-year-old Mason City landmark. The newly renovated Susie Q's Cafe is set to reopen next month. We owe our gratitude to Tyamar Lytle, the young entrepreneur who was making this happen. All of this will complement our Riverwalk. Removal of overgrowth and underbrush, along with trail improvements, should begin this year. The grand opening of Quickstar has given Mason City's South Federal Avenue a new convenience store. Also, on the south side of town, Bushel Boy Farms broke ground for one of the largest greenhouses in Iowa. They will open their $35 million tomato growing facility in September. Nearby, Golden Grain Energy is undergoing a major expansion, adding 10 good-paying jobs. This ethanol manufacturer is the largest property taxpayer in Mason City. On the north end of town, a $63 million investment is placing Kraft Heinz on the cutting edge of food manufacturing. Plant manager Janel Kruger said the upgrade demonstrates the company's long-term commitment to Mason City. Elsewhere, our economic development team is working with 21 active projects with a possible investment in North Iowa of $231 million. The Winnebago River is cleaner and will be more navigable thanks to the Active Living and Transportation Commission and partners who cleaned up more than 2 tons of trash this past summer. The river will be a mecca for wildlife and recreation this spring after the removal of dam barriers below Illinois Avenue. Solar power is already saving utility costs at the public library. This year, it will expand to the water reclamation facility and multipurpose arena. People are coming home to Mason City. Mason City schools actually saw an increase of 31 students in the current school year. This is the largest increase in the last 10 years. One resident, Farouk Jessa, described his decision to move here in a Globe Gazette guest opinion. He said Mason City has what every right-minded American aspires to have as a good quality of life. Are you listening, California, Illinois, Minnesota? Which brings me to the 2020 census. Please join us in participating. It impacts everything from roads to schools to public safety. If we don't participate, Mason City loses money. Let's make sure Mason City counts. Of all the good things that are happening, the one I love the most is our community working together with mutual respect and friendship to get things done. That's why I'm so grateful to our City Council and to all of our partners who are working so well together, including the powerful team formed between Mason City, Clear Lake, and Sarasota County. We have just completed a decade of change. Changes to the face of community and our attitudes about what Mason City is, what it can be. Now we're entering a decade of doing. Putting the finishing touches on the arena, building a world-class hotel, finishing the downtown housing project, creating a river walk for dining, shopping, and recreation. We are not resting on our laurels. There are big challenges that await us. We must do more to improve neighborhoods with aggressive infrastructure improvements. Flood mitigation is essential. Identifying properties in need of repair or demolition is a priority. In addition, we must be responsible stewards of the taxpayers' money. We know there will be setbacks along the road, but we will meet those challenges together one by one. The city we love can be a shining example of the very best in all of us. Thank you for helping to make that dream come alive in the new year. Jane.
And now we will go on to the obituaries, and then we'll come back to the letters to the editor. Today we have obituaries for Anne Marie Duff Shannon, Mason City, Michael D. Scherer, Valois E. Masters of Mason City, Harold Bud Helm Jr. of Mason City, Sheila L. Ott of Norris Springs, Lloyd W. Wynn Peter of Mason City, Dalen Dean Miller of Mason City, Beverly I. Haxton of Colorado, and Charlotte M. Claude of Corwith, Edward H. Albers of Mason City, and Alan M. Coons of Blairsburg, and Barbara J. Dalby of Lake Mills. Anne Marie Duff Shannon, 56, of Mason City, died Saturday, January 11th at her home. Funeral services will be held 11 a.m. Friday, January 17th at the Old Stone United Methodist Church, 1 Jackson Street in Rock Falls, with Pastor Sue Simmons officiating. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, January 16th at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City. Anne was born on April 20th, 1963, the daughter of Warren, Bud, and Patsy Pat Winters Duff in Mason City. She graduated from North Springs Rock Falls High School and worked various jobs throughout her life, mostly for the Globe Gazette in their printing department. Anne married Delavan Shannon on January 24th, 2014. She liked flowers, working in her garden, and loved taking care of her dogs, Ghetto, Lacey, and Isabel. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel is in charge of arrangements.
Michael D. Scherer. Michael D. Scherer, age 70, passed away January 13th, 2020. He was born in Mason City, Iowa on January 11th, 1949, to the late Howard and Edward Scherer. Michael proudly served his country in the United States Air Force and was a professor of photojournalism at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Visitation will be 6 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, January 16, 2020, at Hoy Kaninsky Funeral Home. Funeral service is 9 a.m. on Friday at the funeral home. Interment is at the Hardin Township Cemetery. The family will direct memorials.
Valois E. Masters, 93, of Mason City, died on Sunday, January 12th at Mercy One Medical Center in North Iowa. A funeral service will be held on Thursday, January 16th at 10:30 a.m. at Trinity Lutheran Church in Mason City. Interment will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to service time on Thursday. Memorials may be directed to Trinity Lutheran Church. Online condolences may be left for the family at the Major Erickson Funeral Home website. Valois Eileen Masters was born September 9, 1926, in Esmond, North Dakota, to her parents Eddie and Elsie Hahn Woyen. In 1944, she graduated from Lincoln High School in Tacoma, Washington, and in 1945, she moved to Mason City. On June 1, 1947, she was united in marriage to William Bill Masters in the Little Brown Church in Nashua. Together, the two enjoyed taking fishing trips to Minnesota and going on family trips exploring national parks. Valois was a homemaker that was heavily involved with Trinity Lutheran Church, having various responsibilities with the things she volunteered for. She was also very active with helping with the annual church bazaar. Valois also did volunteer work with Mercy Hospital. She has survived. Arrangements are with Major Erickson Funeral Home in Mason City.
Harold Bud Helm Jr. Harold Bud Helm Jr., 89, of Mason City, died on Monday, January 13, 2020, at the Heritage Care and Rehabilitation Center. A funeral service will be held on Monday, January 20th, 2020, at 10:30 a.m. at St. James Lutheran Church at 1148 4th Street Southeast. Interment will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to service time on Monday. Memorials may be directed to the family of Harold Helm Jr. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.MajorErickson.funeralhome.com. Arrangements are with Major Erickson Funeral Home and Crematory in Mason City.
Sheila L. Ott, age 50, of Norris Springs, passed away surrounded by her loving family on Tuesday, January 14th at the Mercy One Hospice of North Iowa in Mason City. Arrangements are pending with Sheckler Colonial Chapel in Norris Springs.
Lloyd W. Wynn Peter. Lloyd W. Wynn Peter departed this earthly life on January 9, 2020, in his Mason City home. A private family ceremony will be held Friday, January 17, 2020, at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City, where a public visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Interment will be in Pleasant Hill Cemetery, Lime Springs, at a later date. In lieu of flowers, donation can be made to the Mohawk baseball team. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel is in charge of arrangements.
Dalen Dean Miller passed away at his home, surrounded by his family, on January 13th. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, January 17th, at the Dumont Reformed Church. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, January 16th at the Dumont Reformed Church. Burial will take place in the Oak Hill Cemetery, rural Bristow. The Seitzema Vogels Funeral Home of Dumont is assisting Dalen's family.
Beverly I. Haxton. Beverly I. Haxton, age 86, of Wheat Ridge, Colorado, died on January 7th, 2020. Memorial services will be Saturday, January 18, 2020, at 10 a.m. at the Sandalwood Manor, Wheat Ridge, Colorado. Arrangements handled by Kramer Family Funeral and Cremation.
Charlotte M. Claude, 76, of Corwith, passed away Monday, January 13th at Westview Care Center in Britt, Iowa. Funeral services for Charlotte Claude will be held Thursday, January 16th at 11:30 a.m. at St. John's Lutheran Church in Corwith, with Pastor Denise Lindemann officiating. Burial will be in Corwith Cemetery. Visitation will be held Wednesday, January 15th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Ewing Funeral Chapel in Britt and continue 1 hour prior to services at the church on Thursday. Ewing Funeral Chapel in Britt is in charge of arrangements.
Edward H. Albers. Edward H. Albers, 94, of Mason City, and formerly of Clemmy and Goodell, passed away peacefully with family at his side on Sunday, January 12, 2020, at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice in Mason City. Funeral services for Ed Albers will be held at 1 p.m. on Friday, January 17th, at Ewing Funeral Home, 111 Luke's Lane South in Belmont. Burial will take place at the Amsterdam Cemetery in Goodell. Visitation will be held on Thursday, January 16th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Knights of Columbus Hall, 551 South Taft Avenue in Mason City. Visitation will also be held prior to the funeral service on Friday at Ewing Funeral Home in Belmont, beginning at 11. Ewing Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements.
Alan M. Coons, 81, of Blairsburg, passed away Saturday, January 11th at the Iowa Specialty Hospital in Clarion. There are no services planned at this time. The Ewing Funeral Home of Clarion is assisting the family with arrangements. Okay. And Barbara J. Dalby, age 82, of Lake Mills, died Friday, January 10th at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice in Mason City. A service to celebrate her life will be held at 2 p.m. Thursday, January 16th at the Silver Lake Lutheran Church in Northwood, Iowa. A gathering of friends and family will be held 1 hour prior to the services at the church on Thursday. Interment will take place in the Silver Lake Lutheran Church Cemetery, rural Northwood, at a later date. Middlestadt Funeral Home in Lake Mills is in charge of arrangements.
Returning to the letters to the editor. Farmers need more certainty in market. This is written by April Hems in Hampton. Let's face it, in 2019 was a challenging year across agriculture, from trade disputes to an extremely challenging weather year. It's safe to say we've experienced plenty of headwinds. The biofuel sector in particular has come under fire by Washington, D.C. While we've seen some positive news in the state recently, including Governor Reynolds' order to increase the number of state vehicles with diesel engines using B20 biodiesel fuel, a blend of 20% biodiesel and 80% of petroleum-based diesel, and a potential extension of the biodiesel tax credit, the overall biofuels picture continues to be a major area of concern. Adding to the uncertainty for Iowa farmers is the EPA's final renewable fuel standard rule that was just released. From an October 4th deal struck with producers, the EPA was to reallocate biofuels volumes from the 85 small refinery exemptions granted in the past 3 years. The same exemptions that have pulled cost producers 1 billion bushels of lost corn demand. Instead of using a 3-year rolling average to account for actual lost biofuel volumes, the EPA pulled a sort of bait and switch and will be using Department of Energy estimations, which have proven unreliable. This new rule fails to create market certainty, which is desperately needed.
And the next letter to the editor is Invasion of Privacy Codes Need Changing. And this letter is written by Ruth LaPointe of Clear Lake. With the start of a new legislative session, I am calling on Iowa legislators to change the Invasion of Privacy Code in Iowa to better protect victims of peeping toms. The Invasion of Privacy Code in Iowa requires an extremely limiting burden of proof for victims. If a perpetrator is convicted under this section, it must be proved, 1, that their victim was at least partially nude at the time of viewing, and 2, that the perpetrator was aroused by viewing them. It is simply not a crime in Iowa just to be viewing someone without their consent in a space where privacy is reasonably assumed unless these two elements are present. Briefly, here are a few examples of where that burden of proof hurts victims. In 2015, a Des Moines police officer was relieved of charges after being caught spying on female co-workers in their locker room because it could not be proved whether the women were at least partially nude while being viewed. The 2019 case of an employer videotaping his employee while she was breast pumping is ongoing, and the victim faces a burden of proof trying to provide evidence that the employer was aroused. Without proving this, he will be found not guilty. The Invasion of Privacy Code in Iowa needs to be changed to remove these archaic requirements, or victims will continue to face an overwhelming burden when seeking justice in their cases. That is why I am calling on all of our legislators in Iowa to change Code 709.21 this legislative session. Please contact them to request the same.
It's not just about stopping abortion. This letter is written by John Hogan of Mason City. A response to Russell McAfee's letter. A response to Russell McAfee's letter. You're not the boss. You're not the creator. Let each live their own life. Judgment comes later. Saving lives is not just about stopping abortions. It's also about feeding, housing, and educating those souls. If that is your agenda, I'm with you.
And the last letter to the editor today is, beware of Medicare for all. And this is from Kay Bessman of Mason City. Anyone on Medicare, beware of Medicare for all. I am a retired senior and on Medicare plus a supplement insurance. Every year, Medicare goes up, and each year there are changes not always good for those of us who are on Medicare. If a doctor orders a test, x-rays, or a treatment of some kind, always ask if it's covered by Medicare. If not, your second supplement insurance won't pay either. It's all about insurance and money. I'm going through a situation right now and have talked about it to my doctor. I've been told Medicare is not paying hospitals fast enough to keep up with hospitals' cost. A lot of rehabilitation is done now at a nursing home. This, to me, is not fair to the patient when we are paying two insurance companies for our care. Any rehab in a nursing home is not the same being in a hospital for rehab. So again, this is government, Medicare, and to me, it seems they are telling us what they do for care, whether we like it or not. Also, doctors' hands are tied to what they can do for you. Insurance companies and healthcare needs an overhaul.
Turning to our sports page, Sanger's named coaches of the year. Father and son led West Hancock to third state title. After a dream season, the honors just keep coming for the West Hancock football program. Late last week, the Iowa Football Coaches Association named Bob and Mark Sanger its Class A State Football Coaches of the Year. Mark Sanger, who took over head coaching duties from his father Bob this season as the elderly Sanger underwent treatment for leukemia, coached the Eagles to their third state title in program history. "It's a pretty cool deal," Mark Sanger said. "Anytime you're voted by your peers for something like that, it is a special deal. It means you did something right. It continues to be a part of the special season that we've had this year." The Eagles finished with a perfect 13-0 record this season and beat Grundy Center 21-17 in a tense and exciting state title game. It was the program's first championship since 1996. For Mark, being named co-head coach of the year, along with his father, was a special feeling. Though Bob could not be on the sidelines in 2019, he was still a big presence in the West Hancock program, where he has been the head coach since 1968. Bob led the Eagles to state titles in 1973 and 1996. "He is the reason that we are where we are," Mark Sanger said. "I think it's a testament to the entire coaching staff. He put people around him and surrounded himself with people who do things the right way. I think that is the whole point. He's got a system and it works. We stick with it, and it's a big testament to what he has done. It's pretty awesome."
In prep roundup, Mohawks Minor erupts for 33 points in win. This article is written by Shane Lance, Globe Gazette. It was a big night for Mason City basketball team on Monday as the Mohawks broke a six-game losing streak thanks to a breakout performance from its starting point guard. Sophomore Corey Miner scored 33 points against the Bobcats on 12 of 16 shooting with 4 three-pointers in the Mohawks' 84-59 victory. "He's our starting point guard, so he's not a guy from who I expect 33 a game, but I know that he has that potential on any given night," head coach Nick Trask said. "We've just been waiting around knowing that in any given game, he can blow up for us like that." The win was an important one for the Mohawks, who hadn't won a game since their December 2nd matchup at New Hampton. Most of those losses came against ranked Class 5A opponents, but it still felt good to get a victory. "It was nice to get a good CIML win against Marshalltown," Trask said. "Corey did a great job of sparking us right away, and everybody just kind of fed off that confidence, which carried us through the game." Miner is the second leading scorer for Mason City with 127 total points and 14.1 points per game, behind only Jeffrey Skjogen. In addition to those two, Carter Thomas and Avery Melman are both players Trask has confidence in to provide the Mohawks with points. One of the fun things about coaching this team, on any given night, any of our top six could be our lead scorers, Trask said. Any given night, one of those guys can go off, so it's tough for people to scout us on who they can take away. Then Osage 47, Hampton Dumont Cal 26. The Osage boys basketball team scored a 21-point victory over the Bulldogs on Monday night, 47-26. Senior Jonah Bloom led the way for the Green Devils with 23 points while also collecting 7 rebounds. The Green Devils defense dominated in the first half, allowing just 6 points to the Bulldogs. Osage improved to 10-1 on the season, while Hampton Dumont Cal fell to 7. Osage will play Tuesday night against Newman Catholic. Hampton Dumont's next game will be Friday against Clear Lake. Riceville 41, Central Springs 36. The Riceville boys basketball team beat Central Springs by 5 points on Monday night. The Wildcats scored their third win of the season with a 41-36 victory. Junior Sully Fair had a team-high 18 points for the Wildcats, while senior Brody Kinnigs and junior Charlie Ring tied for a team-high 11 rebounds. If I can get the page turned here. And the loss dropped the Panthers to 2-10 on the season. Their next game is Tuesday night at St. Ansgar. Riceville improved to 3-7 and will play at Clarksville. Results were unknown at press time. Girls basketball, Mason City 67, Marshalltown 31. The Mason City girls basketball team crushed Marshalltown on Monday by 36 points as senior Anna Dietz continued her fantastic offensive season. Dietz scored a team-high 17 points for the Mohawks, with Jada Whitner close behind at 14 points. The Mohawks got out to a 46-15 halftime lead and outscored the Bobcats in the second half 21-16. After a tough stretch full of ranked 5A competition, the dominant win was a welcome development. We were able to get our presses going and push the lead ahead throughout the game, head coach Kurt Clausen said. It was nice to get everyone a lot of playing time as well. The Mohawks improved to 7-5 on the season with the win. Their next game was Tuesday against Valley. Results were unknown at press time. Riceville 39, Central Springs 33. The Riceville girls basketball team eked out a win over Central Springs on Monday night, 39-33. The Wildcats improved to 8-3 on the season, while the loss dropped Central Springs to 4-7. Riceville played Tuesday night at Clarksville, while Central Springs played at St. Ansgar. Results for both games were unknown at press time. Charles City 46, Iowa Falls 8-33. The Charles City girls basketball team beat Iowa Falls Alden 46-33 on Monday night, breaking a 5-game losing streak for the Comets. Danny Stock, Liz Pfizer, and Lauren Connell all tied for the team high with 8 points. Sophomore Rachel Chambers snagged a team high 7 rebounds. Charles City improved to 4-9 and played on Tuesday against New Hampton. Results were unknown at press time. And in bowling, Mason City boys roll past Fort Dodge. The Mason City boys bowling team beat Fort Dodge Monday night with a season best score of 2,985 to 2,903. Joe Euchre had a team-high game score of 285. Mason City's next match is January 22nd at Mystic Lanes.
That brings us to the end of the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for Wednesday, January 15th, 2020. Your readers have been Karen and Jane. This broadcast has come to you through a partnership between the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of IRIS or KCMR. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for today's reading of the Des Moines Register. You are listening to IRIS, your 24-hour radio reading service. Have a great day.